Hello and welcome.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Good. Before I would start, I would like to ask you to turn off your phones and every electronic devices you may have on you, so we will not be interrupted by any unwanted noise throughout the lecture. My name is Agnes Beretz, and it's a pleasure to be here today with you. And as you know, I will be talking about the online exhibition, the show which takes place on the sixth floor of MoMA's galleries. It's a temporary exhibition curated by Cornelia Butler, who's the chief curator of drawings at the museum, and the guest curator, Katrin De Zeger. The show is about the history of drawing throughout the 20th century. It starts in the late 19th century and goes until to the early 21st one. And it is not just a historical show, as you will see. I'm not sure how many of you have seen this show. Okay, quite a few of you. That's great. So you will already have some ideas about how the show is structured and what are its main concepts. Those of you seen, you know it. Those of you who haven't yet seen, you will see it. That the exhibition basically is a very generous and quite adventurous investigation of the line and of the medium of drawing. It asks, what is the role and the function of line in drawings, right? And ultimately the question is, what is drawing? What can we consider as a drawing in the early 21st century, looking back to 20th century art? Paul Klee, the German painter, said that, you know, drawing is about to take a line for a walk. Well, this show indeed takes the line for a walk, a long and very expensive and quite interesting kind of expensive and quite interesting walk. So I want to start very, very briefly just to kind of expand on this question, what is a drawing? How can we think about drawings? And this is a question which, if you're a little bit familiar with recent curatorial practices or exhibitions, you know that there are many, many exhibitions during the past, say, 10 years, which were investigating the medium of the drawing, because the drawing as a medium, as a practice, went through major transformations lately. So let me give you a few answers, possible answers to consider to the question, what is a drawing? In a book published in London in 2005, Emma Drexler, a critic, says, drawing is a mark-making process used to produce a line-based composition. That's simple enough, right? Mark-making process, production of lines. These are the main tenets of this statement. The next one comes from an essay by the art historian Pamela Lee, when she says, drawing is the medium that most obviously registers the process of the artist making. Again, the process part, right? Drawing as a performative act, not aimed to produce an object necessarily, but something, a process, a kind of a continuous thing performed by the one who draws. The next definition comes from Laura Hopman, and from the catalogue of a show which some of you might have seen, 2002, she curated the show right here at MoMA. It was called Drawing Na, 8 Propositions, where she said that drawing is in a perpetual state of becoming. And this becoming aspect of drawing as a medium is reinforced in the catalogue of the present show by Katrin De Zeger, where she states, seen as an open-ended activity, drawing is characterized by a line that is always unfolding, always becoming. This unfolding, becoming, performance, process. These are the key concepts where I would like us to start to think about drawing. And my last quote comes from not a critic or a curator or an art historian, but from an artist. An artist who you might remember more or might recall his work as giant lately, monumental sculptures. He's Richard Serra. He was trained as a painter. He did many, many drawings, but he also is engaging in the production and the creation and the construction of lines. So Richard Serra, in a very famous interview in 1977, stated the following: there is no way to make a drawing. There is only drawing. Anything you can project as expressive in terms of drawing, ideas, metaphors, emotions, language, structures, results from the act of doing. Drawing is a verb. Well, I decided to pick up Richard Serra's suggestion that drawing is a verb. And I was thinking about a few works in this exhibition which I liked particularly. And it's somewhat arbitrary, of course, because we have over 100 works on that floor, on the sixth floor, as you've seen. It's a really large, large undertaking. So I decided to use Sarah's model and also to kind of replicate something which he did in 1966-67. This is a verb list which he made, he wrote down. And his interest in language and performative artistic practices is reflected in this. What he was doing here is to creating a list which contains verbs that can be used to make a sculptural form. And he says, you know, to rotate, to surround, to hide, to cover, to wrap, to dig, to tie, to roll, to crease, to fold, to lift, and the list goes on. So if he was right about drawing being a verb, and taking up this model provided by him in this work in 66-67, I will kind of expand on this idea that drawing is indeed a verb, and I will give you a few propositions, a few kind of, you know, dialogical, or maybe it might be a preposterous of me to say, dialectical kind of relationships between two works kind of aligned along one single verb. And in this case, the verb is to draw a line. And I have two examples. I always have two. So the first is by Ellsworth Kelly, the American artist who is represented in the exhibition by a few works. I chose these automatic drawings, which he created in 1950. The medium is pencil on paper, as you can see. The scale is relatively small. It's a whole series of drawings, and they are titled Pine Branches. Pine branch, automatic drawing, pine branch. This is 1, 2, 3, 4, right, from the left, and this is pine branch 5. Well, already it's interesting, it's a serial production, right? Not one, but many, in a small scale. Drawing being intimate, as we think about it, close to the body. Drawing being something which is an immediate kind of corporeal mark-making on the paper. But also it's automatic drawing called pine branches. Well, you have to keep in mind that he gave the titles usually later after he finished the drawings. He did these drawings either not looking at the paper, almost like doodling, right? It's good for people who have attention deficit disorder. You can pay attention to something and, you know, on the side, you can just doodle, just make semi-unconscious marks on a sheet of paper. So he either did that or he blindfolded himself and just tactilely, blindly made those lines on the sheet of paper. And then after he made a series, he decided to call them pine branches. These drawings were on view the first time in Paris in 1951 at the Galerie Arnault. You know that he was in Paris just as Saint Francis was in Paris on the GI Bill. And also the Paris connection is important, not just or especially not for biographical reasons. The very notion of automatic drawing comes from André Breton's notion and the surrealist kind of preoccupation with automatism. Right, Breton, who defined in the Surrealist Manifesto in 1924 surrealism as a psychic automatism, right? The whole idea of automatism, écriture automatique, automatic writing, right? And the surrealist enterprise was to open up, almost as in Sigmund Freud's free association, the creative act, and to make it incorporate semi-conscious, unconscious impulses without thinking about it, without composing, just let it go. Let your hand kind of fly through the sheet of paper. And Kelly was, of course, being in Paris and also kind of being interested in these techniques and strategies, deeply familiar with not just the Bretonian notion of automatism, but also the practice of automatic drawing in the work of Joan Miró, André Masson, and most importantly, Jean Arp. And in the show, you will see a few paper collages made by Arp around 1917, which play with automatism and chance. He also was in correspondence with John Cage, right? John Cage, who, through the notion of indeterminacy and chance-driven musical composition, expanded Kelly's interest and concept of unconscious and chance-driven operations. But one important thing has to be said here. As opposed to the surrealist notion of automatism, which wanted to expand the ego in a certain way, which considered the artist or whoever was making a mark as a mediumistic subject. Right? It's a kind of ego extension. It's a kind of ego theater to a certain extent. In Kelly, it's more about the whole practice of automatic drawing, about the avoidance of his own persona. It's in a way, it's a renouncement of his own authorship. He said, this is a very lovely quote I have here. He said, I want to take the I, not like E-Y-E, but I, like me. I want to take the I out of my paintings. So how do you take out the I? You do not compose. You try to find other ways which avoid conscious decisions, compositions, right, in what you do. And automatic drawing was one of these practices for him, along with many others at the time, like transfer drawing or the use of grids. Okay, the next example in the draw a line section is Richard Tuttle. And you have to pay attention to his work because it's very inconspicuous, it's very difficult to kind of notice it. It's a wire piece on the sixth floor. What I'm showing to you is not in the exhibition, it's a different piece. It's a 44th wire from 1972, the year when he started to work with the wire drawings, the wire constructions. These works were on view the first time, his solo exhibition in 1975 here in New York at the Whitney Museum. You know, it was a famous show because Marsha Tucker, who was the curator of the exhibition, had to resign after the show because a lot of people on the board of the Whitney believed that this is not art, right? And this is too much for the Whitney to explore, to work with an artist like Tuttle. Okay, so the wire pieces, how does he make them? Let me show the thing a little bit closer. This is the end of the line. What he does, and he does these on-site, always himself. He installs these himself. So there is an aspect of performance, right? So he comes to the floor, takes a pencil, standing in front of the wall. The wall becomes like a sheet of paper. And he makes a line, he draws a line on the wall. Then, both ends of the line, he attaches a nail. And then takes a florist wire, something which is quite pliable, right? A florist wire. And then, starting on one end, he attaches the wire, trying to cover his own drawn pencil mark on the wall. And then, when the wire is attached, he let the wire go. And of course, the wire is not staying in place. It's not staying on the wall following the exact outline of the pre-drawn line, but springs off, bounces off from the wall. You see it there, right? And here is another example, not so obvious. I'm just sticking to this one. It's hard to show images of this because it's so incredibly subtle and hard to see. But let's go back here, yeah. So here is the drawn line, here is the wire, and then there is something else. The wire also creates a shadow. So what you have three lines. You have a drawn line with pencil. You have the wire, an actual line in space, which makes this work into a relief or a sculpture on a wall. And then there is the cast shadow of the wire itself. He negotiates object, drawing, and cast shadow. He also negotiates sculpture, drawing, and performance, since he makes them himself on the actual site, also bringing in the notion, at least to a certain extent, of site specificity, right? He does different lines, different, and thus, as a result, different wire constructions on different walls in different locales. And the last thing about this, that there's a certain notion of automatism in the drawing, because the spring and the bounce of the wire itself is not directed by him, right? Fully, at least. But there's also something else. When these pieces come up from the wall, they are basically destroyed. So the work does not exist as an object. Right? The work exists on site for you when you woke up to it and look at it, and then in the form of documentation. Yeah, I just wanted to say one more word about it because we can also talk about, of course, painting here. And you see how complicated is this, because every single work I've shown you today, or especially the Tuttle, although it is drawing, you might argue, he calls them drawing, it uses pencil, but it brings in totally different activities and mediums. And painting is one of them. Why, you might be asking? It is a shadow graph, right? There is a shadow there created on the wall. And if you know, Pliny the Elder wrote about the origin of painting. And Pliny the Elder wrote that, you know, the Corinthian maid, Debutade, after her lover left him, was grieving. And in order to kind of evoke the image of her lover, he made a drawing, a shadow, silhouette drawing on the wall of his lover's kind of likeness, of her lover's likeness. If this is one of the origins of painting in antiquity, at least according to Pliny the Elder, you can argue if the shadow, the cast shadow and drawing the shadow is the mythical origin of painting, then you can argue that Tuttle is not only bringing in here with the wire drawings, performance, drawing, sculpture, but also he refers to the origin of painting as an art in Western culture. Okay. My next example will be about performance, and the verb is to perform line. And here is Loa Fuller, who was an American dancer, experimental dancer, who moved to Paris in the 1880s and became one of the main attractions at the Folies Bergère, the same Folies Bergère which was painted in the early 1880s by Edouard Monet, you know, the extremely sad-looking kind of working girl standing in front of the bar, multiplied, you know, with all the reflection of the interior of the Folies Bergère. So Fuller was a dancer, as I said, but she was also, in a way, not just an experimental dancer, but also a kind of film star, because many of her dance performances were recorded on film. And in the exhibition, you can see a film which is surrounded by a few works by Kandinsky and cubist collages by Braque, Georges Braque, and Pablo Picasso. Well, what does dance, right, experimental dance, have to do with the line, with drawing, you might be asking? What Fuller was best known for, and what I'm showing you here, is that Danse Serpentine, Serpentine Dance, and you can see it here, and also it's another shot. She used colored garments, it's a salmon color silk gown, which had different lengths at different parts. She manipulated the parts and the length of the garment. She added bamboo rods to certain parts of it. And she manipulated these kind of giant parts of the flowing silk, which was made into a plane by the bamboo rod, as if they would be swirling color planes. It's all about motion, the energy of a dynamic body, color, plane, kind of brought together. And also the idea that film can record movement and can show you movement as a montage, a sequence of different angles, planes of a moving body made by the clothing. And the whole idea that half film, and especially Fuller's kind of experimental dances and the films recording these dances, influenced cubism. This was a proposition made a few years ago by Bernice Rose, the art historian, who organized a show at Pace Gallery here in New York. It was at Cubism and Film. And she made a quite convincing and greatly argued point about how Cubist artists and the whole notion of collage with cutting up the plane, just as she was cutting up her own body in movement, was in dialogue. Picasso's and Braque was in dialogue with contemporary dance and especially with Fuller's kind of, you know, dance. And another example, when dance and drawing or works on paper and dance comes together, is Kandinsky, who was extremely interested in the idea of how the line kind of walks through the paper and might suggest to leave that paper. Actually, the title of this exhibition online too comes from a text by Vasily Kandinsky, the Russian artist who, you know, was worked also in Germany, was a professor at Bauhaus, and later in his life was based in Paris. What you see here is from the Das Kunstblatt. It's a German periodical, art periodical, when Kandinsky made these drawings on the right, and the drawings were juxtaposed with the photographs of Gret Palucka, who was another very well-known experimental dancer in Germany at the time. Kandinsky was interested in Palucka's kind of movements, and what he did, following the photographs, he made these drawings, and he considered these drawings, this is about the parallel lines, the body as a line, which multiplies itself by the extension of limbs. So these are parallel lines here, these are curves. What Kandinsky did, he used the moving body of a dancer as a model for constructing and creating lines, to arranging them on the paper. So he basically invented a kind of inventory for lines based on the movement of great palooka. Okay, a very different aspect of how a line can be performed, not necessarily by dance, but by something quite violent, aggressive, and extremely sexual, is demonstrated by the work of Carolee Schneemann, up to and including her limits, which is double dated for a very simple reason. What you see here is a corner made out of paper, covered with paper, right, here and both sides. Crayon marks, colored crayon marks. There is a harness in the middle, suspended in the middle, and there are four screens showing videos where this is an original performance photograph. And what you see in MoMA essentially is a documentation and also a ruin of performances which she executed 9 times in New York in the early 1970s. What she did, she was suspended in this harness and she was swinging her body naked and kind of holding the crayons. She was moving in space, swinging in space, making marks on the surrounding white paper-covered walls and the floor. The body here becomes a tool, a very raw, kind of almost unmediated tool of mark-making. And the crayon marks basically are almost like in a Jackson Pollock painting, and that's not a random similarity here, are becoming the prints, the indexical prints of a moving body. She actually stated that up to and including her limits was the direct result of Pollock's physicalized painting process. That is, what she's doing in the early 70s with the emergence of feminism and the emergence of women artists was a take on painting and mark-making as something kind of subconsciously fluid, gestural, expressive, corporeal. She is not doing that. This is something what we, when I say that, we think about abstract expressionism. We think about Jackson Pollock or Willem de Kooning, right? What she was doing, she was subverting the maleness, right, of this idiom or this paradigm of mark-making. And she said that, no, it's not about masculine virility. I will be using my own naked body, which was objectified in Western art for centuries anyway, and to turn the body from an object, I will turn it into an instrument, into an active instrument. So you see the certain critical stance, the commentary, the gender kind of, you know, issues related to what she does. But also it's, again, just expanding on my interest in how drawing can be brought into connection with different mediums. Again, the aspect of performance here. This, you can argue, also an installation. And there are also the videos, which are montages from the footage, the documentary footage of those performances, those 9 performances, where she actually executed the work. Is this drawing? Is this sculpture? Is this installation? Is this video? Is this performance? Well, we don't know, but it is about lines, for sure. Okay, the next kind of point I'm making is about claiming a line. And to claim a line, there are many ways to claim a line, and you can say that half of the artists in this exhibition are claiming lines. So I'm cheating a little bit, but I think that's okay. But you will see that claiming a line takes us to Nevada. And the first artist who I'm discussing is Michael Heitzer. And Heitzer is very well known as a land artist, known for large-scale, monumental kind of projects which he realizes in remote places, usually in Nevada. He works in the Nevada desert since the late 1960s. If you would like to see one of these now transplanted work, you should go to Beacon, upstate, to the Dia Foundation, where north, east, west, south, one of the works which he originally made in Nevada in the desert were transplanted to New York, to upstate New York, and it's on view there. What you see here is called circular surface planar displacement drawing. And what you see, of course, is not an actual drawing, or it's rather the documentation of these large concentric circles, intersecting circles. I'm showing you another slide here. You see it, how do they intersect? It's almost like, you know, a Kandinsky drawing, actually, which he made in the Jane Dry Lake in Nevada in 1970, Well, what he did is he put down poles. I'm talking about it here. He put down poles in different locations and then attached the rope to the pole. And then he mounted his motorcycle. It's, think about Easy, the very 1970, just 2 years after Easy Rider coming out. Think about that a male artist is kind of riding a motorbike in the middle of a dry lake in Nevada. There's a whole kind of, you know, almost mythological kind of, you know, Western machismo also included in this act, even if it's somewhat ironical. So then he holding the rope attached to the pole in the middle, he was circling. He made circles, making a drawing, making a mark, essentially, on the surface of the dry lake in Nevada. He calls these dry lake drawings, but you can also say that this is essentially, again, a performance. Right? The photographic documentation, which is enormously extensive and was very difficult to do, was done by the use of scaffoldings, different scaffolding, and also I think they used helicopters in certain instances. Of course, the size of the work is enormous. You can see the size here, and I'm saying size because Heidzer loves to talk about not scale but size, because what he wants you to think about is the fact that how long does it take for you to see the gestalt, the formal constellation on an image? Like when you see, say, Robert Smithson's Spiral Jelly, right, which is also a mark made on the surface. And how long does it take to vogue that line? Right? There is a dissonance between what you see and trying yourself to actually cross the land. That's why it's important. Look at the area. It's a huge area. So what's happening here, he had an interest in anthropology and Native American cultures. You can also, you see that interest, think about Navajo sand paintings, right? Think about the idea that you create something which works on with the earth in a large scale, in a semi-abstract way, and then also it deteriorates and disappears. It's not an object. It's not meant to last. It's something which is willingly accept the fact that everything in nature is object to decay and entropy, right? It's not staying there. You can also think about, of course, the Nazca lines, right? That he creates something which really imitates something ancient, something which is there, something mysterious. But also think about this as mechanical drawing. In 1970, when the economical kind of crisis already was in its full, you know, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring came out in the early 60s. This is a dry lake. It's all about the disappearance of nature. It's all about some disruption in the cycle of nature. He makes this even more apparent, being in a motorbike in the untouched wilderness of a Nevada dry lake, and uses this motorbike, something technological, something man-made, right? Something modern, to make the drawing. So claiming a line made by a motorcycle. Here he is with another circular project. By the way, he also made these circular planar surfaces in New York in 72. Obviously, in New York, you can find dry lakes in Manhattan. So he was making circles, concentric circles, etched circles on the concrete in New York sideways. And my second project is by a duo, an artist duo, who in 1966, they incorporated themselves. It's the Baxters from Vancouver. And I will quote their incorporation document. It's Ian and Ingrid Baxter, who were a couple at the time, and in 1966 they decided to call themselves NE Think CO LTD. The abbreviation for this is NETCO. They worked in Vancouver and until 1974, I think, or eight. Until 1978, they were an artist duo slash corporation. What they were doing was the following, as they state on their website: dissolve the boundaries between art and life through interdisciplinary collaborative activities carried out under the rubric of an umbrella organization. Artists as corporations, right? It's a very interesting reaction to the emergence of corporate culture in 1960s America or Canada anyway. They model themselves as artists as service providers. Well, what they were doing here belongs to a series, aesthetically claimed things, or act, as they called it, when they were using images from everywhere. Postcards, images which appeared in magazines, images which were published in exhibition catalogs, and they rephotographed them, they titled them, They stamp them. Look at that. This is the ACT seal, right? They say that this is the NATCO LTD. Consider this as a work of art, right? They take a photograph and claim it. This is their business card. They are absolutely fantastic, and I never knew about them before this show, so I really suggest you, if you're interested, check their websites. It's, of course, a form of institutional critique. It's a conceptual art piece, their whole operation, and it's quite striking and extremely entertaining and supremely funny and smart as well. So what they do here, they take a postcard of a Chilean landscape. It says, crop configurations, Chile, South America, and anywhere else. Which is already interesting. Why do you name it if it could be anywhere else? Is this specific, or is this something particular, or is this something universal? Crop configurations. And then you might be asking, where is the line? Where here are so many lines. Look at these lines here. Look at the crops. Look at the trees, and look at the mountain lines. And think about that. What are the lines which are not made by us, by an artist, but lines made by nature? Right? It's also in relation, of course, Heitzer, who uses nature as a canvas to draw on, the soil has to draw on. So the idea that what is the relation between man-made lines and existing lines in nature, and the whole idea that lines are all over, all it takes for you is to claim them. And that becomes something which is not necessarily a drawing, but it's about lines, spatial constructions. The next example is about measuring things. And of course, we have to start with Marcel Duchamp, because the person who claimed the line, claiming something as yours, is the essential gesture of the ready-made, right? Marcel Duchamp's ready-made is about claiming an everyday object as a work of art, stamping it, dating it, titling it, and saying that that's my work from now on. What I'm showing to you is about, not about claiming in this case, but about measuring, as my work to measure kind of indicated quite clearly. And this is a work which he did in 1913-14 in Paris, and it's called Free Standard Stoppages. You see that it's a quite complex materially piece. It has a wooden box, and the wooden box, I will show it to you, has three pieces of Prussian blue velvet. Oops. Right. These are framed. This is Prussian blue velvet. And in each end, there are holes at the end, and there is a line, a thread, kind of attached to these kind of plates. And then there are three rulers, which are not really rulers. They are 1 meter long each. What they measure, what they follow, is the shape of these lines. So what is this, you might be asking? And here is the original, one of the original. He told us that this is a joke about the meter. Right? But he also explained it a little bit kind of more in a more detailed way in 1914 in one of his notes, which is in a box of 1914, you know, Duchamp notes. It's quite a universe. So this is what he says about the idea of the fabrication of this piece. If a horizontal, 1 meter long, straight thread falls from a height of 1 meter onto a horizontal plane, twisting as it pleases and creates a new image of the unit of length. That is, this is what he did. He took three 1 meter long thread, right, and dropped it over a flat surface, a horizontal flat surface. And the way the thread kind of hit the surface, supposedly, he attached those shapes onto the Prussian blue kind of, you know, surfaces. Right? This is what he said. And then he goes on. Three examples obtained more or less in more or less similar conditions. Considered in their relation to one another, they are an approximate reconstruction of the unit of length. Approximate reconstruction of the unit of length. Well, there is no such thing as approximate or reconstruction of the unit of length. Something either is 1 meter or something is not 1 meter. Actually, what you see here is indeed 1 meter, these lines. Right? But you don't really see them in their length, because not being straight, that is disrupting the whole idea of measuring, seeing, and knowing. He makes for us very difficult, there is a cognitive dissonance here, he makes for us very difficult to actually really realize that all these threads kind of attached to these plaques are the same length, And you lose your capacity to say, indeed, this looks 1 meter. You can't say that. You don't see that. You don't know that. The next thing what he said, the free standard stoppages are the meter diminished. So it's about measuring a line and making a joke on the meter, but also kind of subverting the whole idea of taxonomy, order, measuring. Right? He was also, of course, lying a bit, Lilo, because he said that we believe for a long time that these lines are actually glued to these plaques, but they are not. They are, and this is the title, stoppage. What is stoppage in English? To halt, to stop, right? And this is what happens. He lets the 1 meter long thread go from 1 meter height, and as soon as the thread touches the ground, right, it's about stoppages. It stops. It's a stoppage. Yet in French, stoppage, stoppage, is also about sewing. It's mending. It's an invisible mend. And indeed, the actual length of these threads are over 1 meter because these are not glued. These are mended. It goes back. He actually sewn these things. So it's not just about making you lose your certainty about measuring, to create a gap between knowing that this should be 1 meter and what you see, knowing and seeing, right? He creates a cognitive dissonance there, but also he lies to a certain extent. He tells me that it's a joke about the meter, but don't believe me, you know, I'm cheating, right? And so stoppage as a word, stoppage as halting, stopping, and stoppage as mending a line, using a line in a very functional kind of vulgar manner to mend it, to attach to something, is both valid in this case. And he loves lines. Look at that. A year later, he made Network of Stoppages, which we have, we own, Mama owns this piece, which is all about lines, the intersecting lines, like in a web, kind of meandering through the surface. They were painted over an old painting of his. And of course, the lines, these are the lines, you see these, the capillaries. And I'm not these, these are the broken glass. I'm showing you a detail from the bachelor sections of the large glass, his unfinished, definitely unfinished masterpiece. When these are the Malik molds, the bachelor machines, basically 9 of them, and he connected them by these lines. So line which creates a network, right? Line as a unit of measure. And measuring lines is not just Duchamp's interest. Hiding them and measuring them, distorting them and measuring them and disturbing the very sense and purpose of measurement is something what interested enormously also Piero, what Piero Manzoni was also enormously interested. Manzoni, as you know, is one of the most interesting or engaging kind of figure in post-war European art, an Italian man who had a very, very brief line, not line, he had very long lines, he had a brief life. In 1959, he started to work with lines. What he did was he produced an ink line on rolls of paper. Here there is a quite industrial-sized fabrication. Here is Manzoni. Look at him. Very lovely. He was a tiny man, quite stocky. He's sitting underneath. Actually, he's drawing the line. You see that, right? He has an inked thing in his hand. And then the line kind of, you know, rolls up on a machine. This is one of the early lines from 1959. What he did, he made a line with this ink mark on a roll of paper, then rolled it up, put it into a tube. It could be a cardboard or a metal tube. Then put a label on the tube stating the month and the date of the disclosure of the line and the length of the line. This is, I think, 2 meters. What you see at the exhibition is 1,000 meter long. And the longest line which he made was 7,200 meters, which is quite a long line. Right? So what's going on here? It's a little bit like Duchamp. Duchamp is showing you the line, semi-showing you, because you can't see the back of those plaques, right? But he just disrupts your cognitive perception of length. In this case, Manzoni makes length, makes the line into a secret. This is something what you better believe the artist, but you do not see, right? The line is there, but this is something what is not open for you. Line making, drawing becomes a secret, something which is buried, hidden, concealed from you. Right? Okay. Yeah, he had a lovely quote about this. I put the linear, This is the verb, right? In a container so that people can buy the idea of the Lina. I sell an idea closed in a container. Right? He's selling an idea. He's not showing you the idea. He's just selling the idea. And like very often, like an internet purchase, right? It's a hit or miss. It's a risk. Whether you believe that the line is really 1,000 meters long, you better believe it, but you don't necessarily have to. The whole idea that someone deals with ideas, someone selling ideas, of course, sounds very Duchampian. You know, Duchamp calling himself the salt seller, right? And it's not by chance. Again, there's a connection between Manzoni's kind of interest in concealing, hiding, the whole conceptual twist which he uses for the linear series, which he worked on between 59 and 61. And it is an intentionally kind of, you know, intentional expansion on Duchamp and Duchamp kind of, you know, approach. The next one, we are cutting lines to cut a line. And I'm showing you a performance photograph, a few of which are installed again on the sixth floor by the great, great Brazilian artist who, from the late 60s until the late 70s, during the dictatorships in Brazil, she lived in Paris, Ligia Clark. And what I'm showing to you is Caminhado, which is translated on the wall as walking, but maybe it would be better to think about it as trailing something. And what you see here is a performance photograph when she herself reenacts or enacts a proposition. A proposition which is given for you to do. The idea is that Clark started to work with these propositions, and what she said for this one is to take a scissor, you, the spectator, not just looking, being passive, but you are offered to become active. You are yourself becoming an artist, a performer. So you were asked to take a scissor, take a strip of paper, right, and then start cutting into this paper without cutting it through into lines, into strips, continuously through an unending plane. It's like creating a long, long Möbius. You can stand, you can sit down. You just cut, cut, cut. Well, he started as a painter, and he was always interested in surface, topological investigation, how to create a surface. You will see smaller paper works by her, paintings and drawings in the exhibition next to the photographs of this performance. What is happening here? First of all, one of the most obvious and important aspects that she wants to activate you, right? You are not just looking at the result of what someone did. You yourself are becoming the executor, the fabricator, the performer. There is also, obviously, the emphasis is not being put on the object, but on your own experience of making, right? Your own experience of doing. And she said that there is only one type of duration, the act. This is Ligia Clark speaking. The act that which produces the Caminhado. Nothing exists before and nothing afterwards. It is essential not to try to know while you are cutting what you are going to cut and what you have already cut. Even if this proposition is not considered as a work of art, and even if one remains skeptical in relation to what it implies, it is necessary to do it. That is, what's happening here is an experience, what you have to go through, right? It's your experience, it's your reaction. And why is this interesting? Well, something quite interesting happens. You should actually try it. You should all try this. I tried it a few times. What happens, it's the body, the plane of the sheet of the paper and the movement and the act. There is a totally new perception of how do you see that, how do you feel that. You are made aware of the fact that your body is something closed and finite and static while you cut, while the line kind of keep escaping you, becomes this cipher of infinitude, right? It's worlds away. You are doing it, yet you can't control it, because you are cutting in air, as if you would be drawing in space, right? Can you imagine that, kind of virtually? It is a really interesting kind of experience of seeing your body juxtaposed, set against of what you are doing. You are like almost a monolith doing this. And the line keeps going and going without you knowing it. It creates a certain automatism, right? Okay, so that's one way of cutting a line, making you into an artist or into a therapeutical subject, right? You become a subject here. The other way to cut a line is to use an architectural form. And Gordon Matta Clark, a great and superbly important figure in early 1970s New York art and in the Soho art scene, was doing just that repeatedly and quite often when he was cutting and splitting buildings. In this case, the house was in Englewood Cliff, New Jersey. On the second floor of the museum right now, we have another cut piece by him, Bingo, which three sections of the facade of a house in Niagara Falls. So you can see another work by him actually in 3D. So what he did, he cut this frame house into two, and then he was also cutting stacks of paper. He was stacking the papers on top of each other, creating a thick, sculptural, volumetric, three-dimensional surface, and then cut in between them. Cutting is about taking away, literally, right? It's about destroying, kind of overwriting the topological continuity of the surface. It's violating the integrity of the white surface through a physical violent act, just as here he is violating the house, he's destroying it. He called this practice an architecture. Why? Because it's like anarchy and architecture. It's not architecture to build, to construct, to create, but architecture to cut, to demolish, to disassemble, right? Is the opposite of architectural practice. And what he's doing here, in both cases, I would like you to think about these photographs demonstrating his cutting a house in Englewood Cliff, New Jersey, and cutting stacked paper as similar. Why? Because if you think about it, an American house, a frame house, is an ensemble of planes. Right? Frame houses are made of, you know, the house is basically about planes. And the drawing itself is made about planes. Right? Two very different approach to cutting. One which plays with architecture, the other which brings in body perception, phenomenology of space, awareness, and movement. And the last kind of pair which I'm showing to you is to construct a line, because we need to build something at the end. And after, you know, demolishing, decaying, undoing, unmaking, here is a work by Lisitsky, the great Russian artist, once a student of Kazimir Malevich, who in 1923 in Berlin, for the Große Berliner Kunstausstellung, created a room, the Pranen Raum, the Pran Room. You might be wondering what Pran is. Well, Pran, as he defined it in 1919, was, it's an abbreviation, the word Pran, it's project or design for the affirmation of the new. 1919, the new is obviously it's still called Russia, though, until 22, but the project or the design for the affirmation of the new obviously is not at all unrelated to the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. We are in this phase of the Russian avant-garde when a very radical transformation of social order and political order and life, right? Also kind of ask people or, you know, compelled artists to bring in or to expand on already existing new forms of art making. The Pran, this is a Pran. The first time when he turned the Pran not into a program but also into a series of kind of graphic prints was in 1921. What does this have to do with the new social order, right? With the Homo Sovieticus, with the new man under a classless society in a lived communist utopia? Well, the idea, of course, is that if you work with geometric planes, lines, basic colors, and their constellations, you create a kind of art which does not require any preliminary knowledge. This is the most democratic, most accessible form of art, to use the pure kind of language of geometry. Right? So the Pran, Lisitsky work, just as Malevich's work at the time, or Tutlin, or, of course, Rodchenko, who at this point, is just about to abandon painting for the sake of photography, of course. They all use these geometric shapes. And what Lisitsky is most interested in is not just to compose paintings, but already you see the implied architectural order here. You see diagonals, intersecting planes. This is 2D. His project was to make the Pran into a space, to leave painting. Why? Painting is the ultimate bourgeois object of decoration, right? To leave painting, the wall, the 2D, and turn it into an architectural space, or as Benjamin Buchlow called Pran and Raum, an architectural relief construction, is ultimately to make the visitor, the viewer, to engage with a space, not just to look again. There is an element of activation, right? And to renounce of creating fetishistic artifacts, bourgeois artifacts like paintings. What happens when you walk into this fascinating room is you will realize that your body becomes a line. You will realize that what is happening, that against all those diagonals, you will be the vertical pole, right? Again, there is this idea, a little bit like with Lydia Clark, that you relate yourself to the lines, to the shapes, to the forms which surround you. In the case of Lydia Clark, you are being juxtaposed with the line what you are cutting. Here, your body will form different axes in space. And he said something very short and very smart about this. We have set the pran into motion here. Why? Because you move across space. So perception becomes truly a spatial-temporal discovery, right? It unfolds in space, it unfolds in time. So we have set the pran into motion, so we obtain a number of axes of projection. We stand between them and push them apart. That is, you walk in there and you just give yourself a few minutes, think about what you see, think about your body in relation to what you see. Move slowly, and then you will realize that you are thrown, cast into a dialogue between architectural, 3D, 2D, and with your own body. And you are activating the space yourself. So that's about constructing space and also constructing an experience for you in that space. And the last thing is a work by the young Polish artist who was born in Poland but is based in Berlin and also studied in Hamburg, Germany, Monika Grzmala. And her work, she was already participating in one of the MoMA's project shows a few years ago. She always works with site-specific installation, and she created this installation called Untitled Skeleton of a Drawing above the exit from the show. It's on the wall of MoMA. It's very inconspicuous. It's white as the wall, and it consists of these kind of wire and clay, paper clay. There's a wire underneath, and there is paper clay kind of, you know, put around the wire. You can see the production here, right? These are the pieces. What she did, she made drawing sketches in a notebook. And then taking those sketches, she assembled these structures inside in the museum over the course of 10 days. There's a quite interesting video on the website, which I really recommend to you. You can see a close-up of these wires up there. And then during the installation process, she put the thing up to MoMA's wall, standing on one of these kind of, you know, miniature cranes. So what about construction here? If Lisicki uses architecture, order, geometry, diagonals, horizontals, and verticals in a clean order, here Grzmala is doing the exact opposite. Why? What is ordered architectural and geometric here is not the piece, but MoMA's wall. If walking into Lisicki's room, you become the disturbance. Your body will become the disturbance. You upset, turn around, and subvert that projective geometry which appears on the walls of the space, right? Here, the work, Grzmala's work, is doing that to the architecture. Why? It looks like a branch. It looks like a desert flower. It looks like something, you know, dead, organic, natural. It has nothing to do with this transparent, beautiful, clear-cut order what MoMA's late modernist architecture suggests. If architecture is about, you know, the man-made construction, ordering of things, this piece, look at that. It looks like, you know, they really look like branches of a tree, kind of, you know, taking over the space. The first time when she actually used dead branches when she was working, she was in residence in Marfa, Texas, in the Kinati Foundation. You know, Donald Judd works are on view. And she made a giant site-specific installation using dead branches. So what she does, basically, she kind of takes back the line to nature, to the organic, to something fluid, unstructured, non-rigid, and makes you wonder about, you know, the dualities or the dialogue between man-made, artificial, and natural in the middle of the museum, where nothing is usually natural because it belongs to culture, which is on the very opposite end of this equation. Okay, so this is all I had to say, these were the propositions, these were the verbs I wanted you to see in a kind of dialogue, in a tango. You could see relations among, you know, between those pairs, but also among other works. And if you have any questions or any comments which you would like to make, I'm very happy to answer them. Yeah, thank you. Yes, thank you.